Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, Decoding TV listeners. What you're about to hear is a bonus episode talking about The Crown Season 6, followed by a conversation about what's been going on with the royal family recently. I do just want to note that this conversation was recorded on March 21st, shortly before Kate Middleton announced to the world that she has been struggling with cancer recently. Despite the fact that we didn't know that when we recorded this conversation, we hope you'll still find our conversation about the inner workings of the royal family to be interesting and relevant. Thanks for listening, and if you're a DecodingTV.com subscriber, thanks for supporting this podcast. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Decoding TV, a podcast about television. I'm David Chen. And we got a special bonus episode for you today covering the final episodes of The Crown Season 6. Joining me for this episode, she is known as @joyonapping online, but we call her just Joy here on the podcast. Joy, thanks for chatting with us today.
I am so glad to be back.
All right, let me provide some background for those who are relatively new to the Decoding TV listenership. We covered the first four episodes of The Crown Season 6 many months ago when it was first released, and we made a commitment that we were going to cover the rest of the season. That's something that we do here on Decoding TV. Sometimes we'll cover the beginning of the episode of the show, and then we'll cover the end of the show. And we never recorded that episode covering the end of The Crown. And the reason for that is very simple. Joy got COVID, and it incapacitated her for several months. It was actually pretty
I didn't get the fun. I hear about the kind where you're out for 3 days. That would be lovely. That is very much not what I got.
Yeah. So she was out for 2 to 3 months, basically. And it was actually pretty scary. But Joy has made a pretty decent recovery and is now in a much better place. And also, at the same time as that's happening, it turns out that the royals are very much in the international media spotlight right now. And so we thought, hey, why not?
If The Crown Season 7 is just writing itself before our eyes.
Yes.
There is no plan for a Crown Season 7, but it sure feels like we're living it. We're living the convergence of reality and the show.
Indeed. And Joy is somebody who likes to finish what she starts. So she actually was very insistent that we finish recording this episode to kind of discuss our thoughts on The Crown as a show, and also particularly these episodes as they relate to what's happening in the world right now. So that's what we're going to cover here today on this bonus episode of Decoding TV. I want to mention, by the way, that if you are enjoying this podcast, you can find more episodes at podcast.decodingtv.com or wherever your podcasts are downloaded. And email us, decodingtv@gmail.com. You can also find us across all platforms, including YouTube, TikTok, and Instagram at DecodingTV. And also become a paid member at decodingtv.com. Support this podcast and help to keep it going.
Now, these copies of Spare aren't going to pay for themselves, folks.
Right. So let me provide a little bit of background. You know, it used to be very important for me to have an expert on in a particular show to talk about that show. So we'd have like people like, Don Marshall on to talk about Lord of the Rings, yeah, and Lord of the Rings expert and so on. And so I actually tried to get a Royals expert on mm-hmm. Decoding TV to cover The Crown with us. And the conversation actually got decently far with a Royals expert before falling apart at the last minute. And it was at that point that, Joy, I knew that Joy was interested in the show. And I also believe that it would be, Joy is also one of the smartest people I've ever met. And I believed it would be easier for Joy to become a Royals expert than for me to find one out in the world. And that is what she has done. She has purchased many of the books about the Royals, including things like the Palace Papers and Prince Harry's Spare. I'm not going to say she's been studying it for as long as like Royals experts out there in the world right now, but suffice to say, she is going to be the one bringing the historical knowledge to this conversation.
I am happy to do that, genuinely happy to do it. Also, meta point, I think the fix might be in there's like a reason maybe you couldn't find a Royals expert.
Okay.
And that's because they're all in collusion with the palace at different levels mm-hmm. and don't want to jeopardize their access.
All right. Well, we will see how that unfolds in the days to come. But anyway, so Joy is going to be kind of sharing some stuff that she has learned from, you know, all the reading from Tina Brown and Prince Harry and so on as we progress through this conversation. But let's get down to it. The Crown Season 6, the final six episodes, Volume 2, as it's called. Joy, how do you think we should talk about these episodes? Like, we're not going to go episode by episode.
No,
right?
No, but, you know, we talked about the first, about earlier seasons of The Crown. We've recapped through this feed. And I always thought we were building towards a very tricky Season 6. And we talked about last time when we recapped the Volume 1, how they had actually managed to tell a complicated story in a choiceful, you know, way that is a certain point of view about the terrible events of the summer of 1997 where Princess Diana dies. That is only half the story, though, because the other piece that you're waiting for is how does it fall on this family that is so rigid, that is so private, and that is so stoic. And I thought the first part of it, which is basically like I don't want to use any too visceral language, you know, as real people were harmed in that incident, but sort of the terrible accident and then the impact. I think the accident, they nailed the story of. The impact is just very hard to depict in a narrative way.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what the back half, the volume yes. two, has to, that's the task it is left with. It also is the final season of The Crown. So they have to pick an ending point for all these storylines right. that have been built up over decades of story.
Yeah, so it's a formidable task that is before them. They need to wrap up one of the most consequential things that, like the plot, quote unquote plot line of what is, one of the most consequential things that has happened to the royal family in the modern era, and also wrap up this very prestigious show that's been running for many years, that has had multiple casts.
Us to so many interesting characters,
yes.
of whom I think Princess Margaret and Prince Philip are two folks that people got to know with really distinct personalities, like forceful personalities, and, you know, ask like, well, what happened there?
Yeah.
And does the show do that? Like, we can talk about it thematically. But so basically today, I think we should talk at a high level about the six final episodes. We don't have to get into it one at a time, but I'll just sort of describe overall what happens. Also, I think we should talk about how well the show functioned overall, since we're decoding yeah. TV. It's quite novel as a storytelling structure compared to anything else that has ever been made. And then I think it would be really helpful, may not be helpful. I would like to opine a little bit on what I think is going on with Kate Middleton.
Yeah.
Having really done quite a deep dive in recent days on different perspectives of that were all written prior to the recent media frenzy around her whereabouts and wellness.
All right. Sounds great. So why don't we start with that first question? And actually, you know, I do just want to shout out one other thing, which is that given that Joy has done all this research, we were also planning at some point to cover on Decoding TV the new Netflix original movie Scoop, which is about Prince Andrew's disastrous interview in which he tries to defend his connection or lack thereof to Jeffrey Epstein. So that's something we're going to try to put out as a bonus episode over the course of the next couple weeks on the Decoding TV feed. So that's something you can potentially look forward to. And if that's something you're interested in, by the way, actually, you know what? Let us know. At decodingtv@gmail.com, we'd love to hear from you. But let's talk about these episodes. And as you said, you know, to recap our...
quickly. Yeah. Scoop will come out on April 5th
yeah.
on Netflix. And what a stacked cast. Gillian Anderson.
Yep.
Did she pronounce it?
Gillian. I'm pretty sure it's Gillian Anderson.
Miss Anderson. Agent Scully. Keeley Hawes. And then Rufus Sewell.
Yeah.
Playing Prince Andrew. I really had to do a double take at that casting, but I've seen some images of him in it, and thanks to the miracle of prosthetics, I think he doesn't look like Rufus Sewell, at least.
Yeah.
But that is an awfully handsome man to be playing such a doughy character.
Indeed. So anyway, to recap our thoughts on the first four episodes of season six of The Crown, I think we were both huge fans of how the final days of Princess Diana are depicted. It just felt like it was well thought out, that people who had not previously been given a lot of humanity in the public storytelling around this event were given that humanity, and that it was this kind of very... It was rendered in a sufficiently tragic way that's kind of did some amount of honor to the actual real life events, and also told this self-contained story that was kind of, from a storytelling perspective, just satisfying to watch in and of itself, right? Like,
yeah, I think I was particularly struck by the episode two called Two Photographs, in which, and I think about it still, incredibly relevant to the news today, that there is like a formal photographer that's very buttoned up, and then there are paparazzi trying to capture, you know, the same subjects, and the ways in which the press, you know, hound the family, particularly Diana, creates all this pressure because there's really a race on to influence public opinion. And in some ways, the royal family's preferred toolkit is just becoming hopelessly outdated.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, as you already indicated, the latter half of the season deals with the aftermath of Princess Diana's tragic death, Prince William and Kate Middleton's courtship, and also, ultimately, Queen Elizabeth's decision of whether or not to step down or stay on the throne, right?
And Charles and Camilla.
And Charles and Camilla, and also... Tony Blair does some international stuff. That's kind of what happens this season, right? So ultimately, Joy, you know, should we start with overall thoughts on the latter half of The Crown season six, right? Like, did we think this was a successful final closing to the show? What'd you think, Joy?
You know, I've really sat and thought about if you had to start from 1997 and end the show at some time, given the approximate pace of how much this show can cover in an episode. Did they pick the right time to end it?
Mm-hmm.
And effectively, it ends approximately around Charles and Camilla's wedding and also the queen planning her own funeral, which is particularly poignant because by the time this airs, the queen has passed away.
Right. Which is not something they could have known at the time, right?
Right.
I don't think they knew that she would be gone by the time when they were filming it.
Yes, but she was in pretty decline. It was a reasonable likelihood.
Mm-hmm.
And so I do feel that some of the, particularly the strong emphasis on the bagpipe in the final, well, I do think they kind of knew, or they mm-hmm. wove in some elements from reality. But this was as good a structure as any to hang it on, because there's actually not really a satisfying way to move this story along and introduce the next generation without opening up this just giant can of worms about Will and Kate, about how is Harry doing, and what is Charles and Camilla's status. A lot of these things sort of float in limbo for a pretty long time. So I actually thought creating this structure where we basically end up with her reflecting on her own life and recentering the queen as the center mm-hmm. part of the story was the best choice they made. It also allows us in this... it feels like a potpourri kind of structure in the final six episodes. So we definitely get a clear sense of the queen reflecting on her own life. And I think that's a strong way to end it. We also get to have some sprinkles of people we've seen before. Like, we spend a fair bit of time with Princess Margaret, which is poignant and worthwhile. We get to see Mohammed Fayed again. I'm not like super thrilled with the way he was portrayed, but you know, like, okay, at least we kind of get to know like what happened to our characters.
Yeah.
And we get to watch the boys, William and Harry, struggle with not their grief exactly. It's partly that, but they also struggle to find kind of their footing as they are really awfully young and just becoming young men as all of this press attention surrounds them. And of course, they're dealing with the tragedy. I think it was an okay final batch. It has a strong final note, We get to see some really strong characters, but there are some odd choices, like big focus on, you know, Kosovo. And what we don't see is there's really, for me, no satisfactory conclusion to the end of the Diana story. That's the biggest
miss. It is a massive whiff, in my opinion, that, like, I think they did such a good job setting it up and depicting, you know, how the tragedy unfolds and the day of. It feels so kind of sad and... but at the same time, there's also this inevitability to it that kind of creeps in. There's this dread that's in there. And so the first four episodes, volume one of the season, were so strong. And then I think the Diana stuff basically takes up like roughly like 1.5 episodes of the final six episodes. You know, like it does, it really doesn't feel like it, at least from an emotional perspective. You know,
it's strange how much it recedes.
Yes.
And it's sort of like, well, whose perspective are we in? Because I think for some people, it doesn't recede at all. And for some people, it maybe they try to compartmentalize it. It's just hard to understand the tone, I think, in the final six episodes. So, and you know, if we wanted to bring in more Diana, there was convenient ghost Diana, but she doesn't show up again. And so this giant choice they made in the first volume to have a sort of manifestation of Diana speaking to people is no longer there.
I was really disappointed in how the aftermath of the Diana storyline is handled. There is an episode, I think is it episode five, that deals with it mostly with, I think it's Will's Mania, right?
That, yeah.
Where Prince William confronts his father about Diana's death and blames his father, and eventually the two of them reconcile. And but that feels like the majority of how this situation is dealt with. And then there is also, obviously, we get the case and the final readout of exactly what unfolded that night. And, you know, so there is some more additional material after that. But then the show spends quite a bit of time on the William and Kate.
But courtship. It doesn't really build it to like them getting engaged or them getting married. Famously, you know, she wanted to get engaged sooner, and it was 8 years of dating before they got engaged. So maybe the show couldn't extend its timeline that far. But it really, I swear, the final six episodes, it's a mix of like, oh, hi, I'm happy to see you, character. Let's, great to spend time together and see what you've been up to. Oh, you know, that's sad, you know, what you've been up to, but I'm in it with you. And then a lot of other things that feel like et cetera, or just like bringing up things that are so tantalizing. Harry at age 12 clearly has a drinking problem in the way that he is depicted. He is constantly sneaking drinks or offering other people drinks at age 12, 13, 14. And so they don't follow up on that. In real life, that is not necessarily untrue, but that's an awfully salacious way to put it. And so they're just sort of hints of things. And so I just wish they had made sort of stronger, firmer choices on the additional pieces of the plot.
I agree. The whole time we're spending time with, you know, the decision to include the William and Kate courtship makes the show much more interesting in retrospect, given all the stuff that's happened recently. But I agree, it was not the most compelling storyline of the show.
Did it have a storyline? They met. They were actually very boring.
It does depict Kate's family as social climbers that engineered their relationship.
Yeah.
And so that is pretty interesting, I think. But beyond that, I think you're right that there's not that much there. I think you're right that one of the stronger elements of the final half of the season is recentering it on Queen Elizabeth. We get a little bit more of Queen Elizabeth's relationship with Margaret, which is actually really well done. We finally learn why Leslie Mandel took this role, which is she got to depict Margaret in her last days. And then the final episode of the show, you know, Imelda Staunton, I think, is a fine actress, but the show's depiction of Queen Elizabeth in this era has been, I would say, borderline disastrous. It's just been the least interesting character on the show. There's nothing, like, we not only get very little of her interiority, but what we do get is boring and not particularly compelling. But despite all of that, I do think that the way the show sends her off is quite lovely.
It's the best they could do, certainly, with what we had been given going into it. Yeah. So why don't we talk about the ending specifically?
All right.
There is a completely made up, guys, okay? Definitely not true. Self-debate. Or it's certainly, we don't know it to be true. I mean, anything could be true in somebody's head.
Right. Like Queen Elizabeth never released memoirs, right? Like.
Absolutely not. She didn't even give interviews, you right. know? So like, she barely ever like appeared in anything. She, that wasn't scripted.
Right.
She did not have a out loud debate about whether to basically step down early.
Yeah.
And allow Charles, who is quite grown at this point, yeah. To become king while he still has like basically time and youth and energy to shape the position of the crown. But really, like, Charles does have a long game policy platform mm-hmm. and a number of things he cares about. Do I find Charles annoying? Yes. Do I think he called it right on climate change? Yes. You know, I will give him that. And yes. so
let's give him the climate change. But anyway, yes, this takes place in the final episode with Imelda Staunton playing Queen Elizabeth debating the younger versions of herself as played by Claire Foy and Olivia Colman, right? Each of which has a different position on whether she should continue.
So Claire yeah. Foy is given the continue.
Yes. She's the youthful, like, let's have the spirit. You have the spirit of my youth in you. Please keep going. Right.
And Olivia Colman is given, and I don't, so first of all, there was not to the extent that we even know any question about abdication. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, I don't think that it's totally fair to give Claire Foy the one and give middle-aged, you know, Elizabeth.
Right, right.
In.
From what we know of Claire Foy, was her like thing, like, yes, this is definitely the best thing ever, you know? Like,
yeah, and Olivia Colman gets the, like, you know, maybe you should let them take it.
Right. It's clearly just the show's way of shoehorning in
these two actors
who have helped to define the show over the course of many years, so, yeah.
And then I will say, although it overall worked for me, I did not love that there was actually, I don't know if you recall, but there was actually a fourth Elizabeth.
Mm-hmm.
It was very young Elizabeth.
Oh, that's right.
Very young Elizabeth, who had snuck out and gone to the Ritz on sort of a Victory Day party with Margaret in her little uniform. I would include the whole Ritz sequence in my lowlights of this show. And so to see a reminder of it in this final poignant moment did not quite work for me, but they didn't have her have a big role. She just sort of had an appearance.
There is a flashback to Elizabeth's younger days where you kind of get a glimpse into the life that Elizabeth might have had if she was just a young woman instead of the Queen of England.
That is the goal of the sequence.
Right. And it is extremely clunky, but I do think it is worthwhile to remind people that someone specifically like Queen Elizabeth did give up a lot to do what she did, right? And if there's anything about this show that if there's a thesis to this show, at least this season, I do think it is that this person was singular in some ways. And and I do actually David Chen actually agree with that.
I believe it too.
You know? So, so yes, super clunky, the Ritz stuff, the jazz stuff, the dancing stuff. It's not great, but I like the spirit of what it was trying to do.
You know? And what you got out of it is that she gave up a lot of what? Dancing with the jazz?
No, just that,
freedom to be a person.
Right. Freedom to be a person, to go out
she
and
wasn't.
Have a night on the
town. She was a princess. She was still next in line.
I know, but like she, you know, a normal human like you and me, we can just go out and have a night on the town if we want. And like,
but the princess cannot. She still had to be snuck out.
That's my point, is that she gave all that, like, you know, presumably if things had played out differently for her somehow, that, you know, she might not have. She was not always going to be the queen, right?
She was always going to be the queen unless she produced an heir and it skipped.
No, again. I know. But like before the abdication, right?
Oh.
That's what I'm talking about. Like, that's what I'm saying. Like, yeah. So anyway.
Oh.
All right. So.
Okay. That's kind of fair,
yes,
I guess.
Absolutely.
he had not married Wallis Simpson and produced a different heir and had not abdicated. And
yes,
had,
that's all.
I mean, truthfully, like the UK would barely exist then because they he would have just handed it over to the Nazis. Like there would have been no Victory Day party.
Yeah.
For her to go dance at the Ritz.
Right.
It would have just been welcome German tanks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Our shores are yours.
Well, it was either Elizabeth gets to go have fun and, you know, or we can have England, right? And it's like fair trade.
Okay. those are all oblique references to the fact that David was a Nazi sympathizer.
What? Okay.
Not David Yu.
Okay. You're talking about me. I was like, what?
The king who abdicated.
Yeah.
The king from the king's speech who left.
Yeah.
Okay.
Back on track.
I would have loved to have seen when, in that episode, which is meant to be this, I think it's meant to really set up the grand sweep of history. It's the episode with Margaret.
Yeah.
Margaret is aged, hanging out in Mystique, having, unfortunately, like escalating health problems due to strokes and scalding her feet. You know, it's really sad to watch her, you know, physical decline. But in her memory, she recalls a much younger Elizabeth. To have that dialogue, you know, inserted, that interplay of ideas, I think it would have worked for me maybe if it had not specifically been the jazz and the dancing. It felt like there was a really pointed commentary. Oh, look, she's open to, you know, interracial friendship or whatever, in a way that feels like a direct rebuff of the Meghan Markle Prince Harry Oprah interview that had aired,
mm-hmm.
which is like, look at how racist this family is and how awful their, mm-hmm. you know, quiet chatter is.
It felt a little bit image rehabilitating-y to you.
Yes.
That whole sequence, yeah.
Yes, it felt pointed. You're like, pointed at what? So, you know, while that didn't work for me so much, overall, the end does work. And I have specifically thought many times since then, watching this family go through whatever it's going through over the winter and spring of 2024, I thought of the line from the end of The Crown, where basically, I think it's Jonathan Pryce, Prince Philip, who says, or is it a past Elizabeth who says to Elizabeth, just look at them all. They're not ready. Like, you are the one who holds it all together. You can't go anywhere. And of course, that's meant partly to be a moment of acknowledging the 2023 air date grief for saying goodbye to Queen Elizabeth, right? But it's also in the show, it's set in like 2005 when that's aired, and it's like 18 years past and they still weren't any more ready.
Right. The final sequence of The Crown has gone viral online recently, where I've seen people saying like the end of The Crown basically predicted the events of the last few months or years. There is a quote that from the final episode, you will continue as queen for as long as you possibly can for one reason. Because those are the rules? No. Because those that come after you are not remotely ready to take over. And she says, but I wasn't either. Remember, I was so young. Ah, no, you were always ready.
And the show does depict Charles as mopey and obsessed with Camilla and trying to like rehab his image. And, you know, Will is just kind of too young. It's pretty kind to Will and Kate,
yes.
I think, out of, I think, respect. Like, I think they're pulling their punches a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then Harry is a juvenile drunk who dresses up in Nazi uniform because he doesn't think too hard about it. They were actually even a little nice to him on the Nazi thing. It did happen, but they're nicer than how he recounts it. He puts more blame on himself for it, but he also blames Will and Kate. He says they signed off on the costume and thought it was hilarious. So I think that is a kind of gut punch to think about, because maybe the monarchy really ends with her.
Mm-hmm.
And
I mean, not literally, because it's obviously still going, but like maybe anyone on earth thinking of the monarchy as a relevant or effective institution ends with her, right?
With like so much reverence and respect.
Yes.
And we'll see how the rest of the year plays out. But just since the first you know, since these episodes aired until we're recording this now, so much has happened. Kate Middleton was seen at Christmas and not since.
Yeah. She has not made an official public appearance since.
There have been two paparazzi photos, one paparazzi video, and then a self-distributed disastrous
Mother's Day photo,
that was like pulled back by news outlets for being so highly manipulated. So no one's had like a really credible good look at her that wasn't from a great distance or, you know, rendered through Photoshop. Prince Charles sadly was diagnosed with cancer such a short time after taking the throne. He is seeking herbal treatments, and because he really believes in sort of homeopathic medicine, he is taking some amount of step back from his official duties. And in the past, you know, there's this idea of like the working royals, the people who have active slates of patronages of nonprofits and charities they show up at, public events that they go to, some of them glamorous, some of them not, but that they're official sort of designees of the family. You had the Queen, you had Prince Philip, you had Princess Anne, you had Charles, you would have Camilla when she comes in, you'd have William, you've had Kate, and then you would have theoretically had Harry and Meghan. Well, Harry and Meghan are gone. Charles is sick. The Queen is gone. Prince Philip's gone. Like, suddenly the number of working royals is incredibly small. So Camilla was supposed to step up and take a bunch of Charles's work, and she did for like 6 weeks, and then she needed a rest. Because the royals do an exhausting calendar that is set a year in advance or more of all of these, you know, their day is known down to the day part, you know. Camilla steps in and then needs a break and has now, I think, flown off to an island or something for like a holiday because despite Camilla hating flying, you know, she's just too worn out to keep going. And so it's like, where is the family? You know, William was supposed to attend a funeral of another sort of royal personage in another country who I think they're distantly related to and had to pull out recently.
Yeah. And Harry and Meghan are obviously, you know, have excused themselves from royal duties and are not even in the country, right? So
excused themselves or were fired. But yeah, you know, like it was, that's a matter of debate. But they're not even in the country. They're certainly not working royals. And if anything, they are creating competing messages that create more work for people to try to navigate through. Example, you have a climate change summit. You know, you're trying to get Charles to record a message. Charles offers William to set William up for the next phase. But Harry also wants to be seen as the face of climate change. So do you say yes to the Sussexes or do you say no to the Sussexes? The climate change summit, the big one, said no. But Meghan has launched a lifestyle brand very recently called American Riviera Orchard Montecito. So we will all be looking forward to whatever. You know, she clearly needs to work on some level. They need to work to afford the incredibly expensive security detail that is required to keep their lives in any kind of order. And I'm sure they have other major living expenses too. And so there's a sense that like no one is doing the work that Queen Elizabeth did.
There's no one in charge right now, basically.
There's no one in charge to arbitrate things, but there's also no one doing the sort of stately, steady, I'm just showing up. Hello, here I am.
Yes.
I represent the
crown. I'm reading the boring speech.
The crown is still here.
I'm shaking hands. I'm waving. You know, there's no one doing that on a day-to-day basis.
The Windsors can model, you know, the stoicism and sort of neutral, slight peppiness that, you know, they always brought.
You know what it kind of reminds me of is, I'm going to say this is going to be really weird, YouTubers. And what I mean by that is, there's people who I know who make YouTube videos for a living. And many of them are scared to stop making YouTube videos or to take a break because they believe, with very good reason, that the YouTube algorithm will no longer favor them
if they take a break.
If they've been producing weekly videos for 10 years and then they take 3 weeks off, maybe when they make their next video, it won't be as popular as the other videos. And that's
and they'll fall into permanent disfavor?
It's possible, you know, like now in reality, it's never really that simple. But the reason I bring that up is because in some ways, the royals kind of depend on people seeing them and believing in their legitimacy to exist, right?
Yes.
And so if there's just no one showing up and no one being at things for an extended period of time, it does call into question how viable the institution is in the long term, right?
Well, I think, you know, there's a, I think it was Elizabeth who had the saying, you know, that this family needs to be seen to be believed.
Yeah.
And in this age where everyone is carrying around an outstanding camera in their pocket, sometimes, like, you know, it's one of several devices they have that could create great photos or video. There's such a ubiquity to selfies, you know, like how hard would it be to produce a credible image? I think that is part of why we're in this like very weird moment where it feels like it takes the least amount of work ever to be quote unquote seen.
Right.
Like just brush your hair, don't even put on, you know, just stay in your pajamas and then take a selfie from that up.
If Kate Middleton was making TikToks every day, no one would have any problems right now, right?
So, well, I'm sure they'd have other problems, but yeah.
A smaller percentage of people would be having problems. But anyway, the point you were making was that even since we recorded our last episode about The Crown, things have really gone downhill for the royals in real life.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
In a way that strangely reinforces the statements made at the final episode of the sixth season about how none of these people are ready to take over, right?
Yeah, and you know, again, I know they had to end it somewhere. Where they ended it was just fine. But like to bring us up to today, from 2005 to 2011, you know, I'm not going to do this perfectly because it's not going to map perfectly. But, you know, Harry does go through, he has a temper problem after his mom dies. You know, he gets really, really aggravated really easily. And then he kind of, and he carouses a lot, but he settles down. He's really beloved as sort of like the scamp, you know, of the family. Mm-hmm. He settles down eventually by joining the military and has like a genuinely distinguished military career. Even in the military career, it's tough for him because he is singled out by the enemy. He really wants to be in combat and it makes everyone around him in terrible danger. So twice he does deploy, but he isn't really able to fully fulfill everything he wants to do because, you know, he has to be protected so carefully. And he understands like the cost of that. But I think he comes out of that a much better, more settled person. Again, like really beloved. And we enter like in the 2010s era. This is a great era for the Windsors. Like Will and Kate finally get engaged. They have a very beautiful wedding. It's quite glamorous. And, you know, the London Olympics are hosted. Like things are just so good for... I don't know if you remember... we got married in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
Did we?
No.
We got married, but in the 2010s.
Yeah.
And we went to London as part of our honeymoon, and it was like people were telling me, "Oh, you'll have the best food in London that you can have in the world, and if you want to have amazing Chinese food, you can have it in London. If you want to have amazing Indian food, you can have it in London." Like it really felt like this incredible melting pot. It felt very vibrant to me in a way that like going to Paris felt like less so, which really felt like a huge shift that Paris wasn't like the culinary capital for our honeymoon.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So basically I think you're saying like in the time since the events of the show were, you know, ended,
there was a really good stretch.
Really good stretch where, hey, the royals are in the news. They're glamorous. London feels like it's doing well. You know, like things are on the up and up. Maybe we don't need, quote unquote, need Queen Elizabeth for this institution to be relevant after all.
It all felt like it was going according to plan. You know, there's additional children who are being born. They're super photogenic and adorable. The family's growing. We're seeing all the generations together with, you know, the great grandmother all the way down to the great grandkids. And then it hits the skids like 2018, 2019. And it's been on the ropes like ever since.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it is very unclear to me how this chapter is going to play out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the skids is Meghan Markle joins the family and is a very, very uncomfortable cultural fit. Clearly has not watched The Crown.
Right.
Because she goes through exactly what Diana went through.
Yeah. Yeah.
Having read Spare.
The Prince Harry book. Yeah.
I am actually shocked that Prince Harry, from his own point of view, if you believe his words to be true, which I do, this book is in many ways unflattering to himself. So I assume it's probably true. He himself doesn't know how to navigate the palace, even though he grew up within it. So he knows who to curtsy to and he knows the right things to say. But like when he wants to get something done, he actually finds out, oh, that can't be done or that can't be done in that way. And he frequently is just flabbergasted at protocol, what is legally required to marry somebody who's a divorcee, you know, like, can the dress be made of this? Oh, it can't. Why? You know, like there's so much that he himself didn't know. So I really give Meghan a lot of space because he was supposed to be her guide, right? Mm-hmm. To like figuring out how to navigate all mm-hmm. of this.
You're addressing a critique that many people have had about Meghan and to a lesser degree Harry of like, wow, did she really not know what she was signing up for, right? And I think what you're saying is plausibly, right?
I think he did not help her that much.
Yeah.
And it sounds like nobody helped her that much. And I'll come back to this point. But suffice it to say, I'm trying to not get too into the weeds about Meghan Markle, but Meghan Markle is very, 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 very unhappy married into this family.
Yeah.
She's talked about it on Oprah. We watched her Harry and Meghan documentary. Spare covers some of the same topics, but in a lot greater depth. And, you know, they end up choosing to renounce, to give up their titles and end up, leaving the family entirely. That's all like late 2019, early 2020. And then literally same time frame, November 2019, that is when Prince Andrew gives his disastrous interview that we're about to watch a movie about in a few weeks.
Yeah. Brutal 1-2 punch to the royals.
Yes.
Right?
So as these sad occasions are happening, you know, the pandemic starts.
Yeah.
Prince Philip passes away in 2021. The queen is sitting there thinking, like, how many military titles do I need to strip from my multiple, you know, scions here? You know, like it is just the amount of attrition in this family is just so high all of a sudden. And I really don't think we've fully recovered from that era. Harry and Meghan are off being very famous on their own, and they're very generally supported in America. So I think they have certainly like a lot of pulpit, you know, if they want to make an announcement, it's news. And then Andrew is sort of permanently disgraced, and Charles is ascending the throne, but with this kind of unpopular and awkward situation where the queen now is Camilla, a person who everybody fought to keep off of the off of the throne. So I still
can't. The one reliable person right now is Camilla. Yeah.
And so I really don't know where it all ends. I don't know obviously what will happen with Charles's health. Who knows what's going on, you know, with Will and Kate and the pressure of the current situation that they're in. But it is hard to believe that anybody could fill the giant vacuum in terms of seniority and presence and gravitas that the queen seemed to bring.
Yeah. It is astonishing how fast the fall has been, you know, how rapidly the stature of this institution has degenerated over the course of the last few years. But you know, one might argue it's overdue.
Right,
for it, you
right.
Know? So
Americans, I think, are pretty unsympathetic.
Exactly.
To it just continuing for its own sake.
So why don't we finish up talking about the show, The Crown, and then we can talk about some of the stuff that's been going on recently and how you're thinking about it. But I guess, are there any other closing thoughts you have on this season?
The most important decision made in Volume 2 is to try to fill in a mystery. So as I described in Volume 1, you know, they recount events in an accurate way, but then they fill in the gaps of things that are not known to a pretty large extent with a story of their choosing. It's a believable story. It's not settled fact, but it's a believable version of events. They do the same thing in Volume 2 with the big mystery of how does Kate Middleton come into William's life.
Right. A commoner, basically, right?
She is a commoner.
Yeah.
She is not just a commoner, but she's middle class, which in Britain doesn't mean what middle class means here. But she's the equivalent of upper middle class here. So she would be actually a very American kind of story, which is like her mother was a flight attendant. Her father, I think, worked in air traffic control, but like her mother on the side built up a party supply business out of like their extra garages and storerooms, and then built that into a sizable business, which allowed her children to go to fancy boarding school. And that kind of upward mobility is common and praised and unremarked upon in America. Would you agree?
Yes.
That is...
I don't know about unremarked upon, but it's like, you know...
But it's yeah. It's considered like, good for you.
Good job.
Yeah,
good job.
The American dream, you're yes. doing it.
Nailing it.
In the UK, my sense is that there is a lot more class snobbery, that class is something that money alone cannot buy.
Right.
And so the amount of climbing that is required to then get your kids into the school where they might become friends with the girls, to get invited to the kinds of parties where they might then run end up, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like, there is the rise is meteoric for this family in mm-hmm. terms of like class and rank, right? Mm-hmm. So I think the British press, if I am to believe Tina Brown, are very suspicious of how this all went down. And there's a version in which it's basically Kate's incredibly long game starting when she's like 17 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I can lay that out. But this show decides, I think in some ways they don't want to touch that because that's a little too hostile to the person who will be queen.
Right.
Possibly soon.
Right.
And so... they decide to basically throw the mom under the bus and say, it is a scheme, it is a plan, yes. but it's the mom.
It was the
plan.
Mom all along.
Yeah.
Right. Who I think is played by that woman from House of the Dragon, right?
Correct.
Yeah, yeah. So
correct.
they're both scheming in their own ways.
Yeah.
Both characters
she's
playing.
Only one has a dragon.
Right, yeah. So, and so...
How did this sit with you? Did it, like, I knew some of this story... You came into it cold. Did this strike you as a believable depiction of like a tiger mom?
Yeah, I have to say that if she engineered this whole thing, it's a pretty big accomplishment. You know, it's like, I'm not even mad. That's pretty impressive that she was able to do that. I think the problem is I just didn't care that much about these characters, like as depicted on screen.
For sure.
But it's the idea of like, hey, I'm gonna make my daughter go to specific schools and on specific trips for the possibility that she might intersect this guy and then catch his eye. You know, game recognized game. That's just some really audacious social engineering, I have to say. Now, you know, I'm not even commenting on the ethics of it. I'm just saying the magnitude of the accomplishment is great. But yeah, the whole time I was watching this whole plotline, I was like, why aren't we spending more time on the fallout of the Diana stuff? That's kind of my recollection of.
Well, and I think there was a way to tell those two stories together. For instance, what is Kate's enduring quality? She is incredibly steady and reliable. Mm-hmm. She never makes a fuss. She never makes it about her. Certainly not publicly. And so you could imagine coming from so much chaos, why that would be appealing.
Mm-hmm.
Also,
for who? The royal family in general?
For yeah. William.
Mm-hmm.
Also, she has a family that's incredibly close-knit. She has a brother and a sister who hang out, and everybody is together. They all go on family vacation together with the parents. And William would frequently join them on these trips. And the idea of a nuclear family where everyone wants to get along and mm-hmm. the children want to support the parents and everyone is just overtly loving to each other, I think is probably like a lovely thing to try to just experience.
Right.
So in some ways, it's not their ordinariness, but maybe their wholesomeness.
Yeah. Yeah. But the show didn't really lean into any of
that. It really, really didn't. And I wished it had. Yeah. I really wished it had.
Yeah.
But instead, we get this very Machiavellian version, which I think whiffs of a certain kind of snobbery, which is like, oh, you couldn't possibly have this outcome without somebody playing a very long game.
Right.
And I think this is another way they could have thematically tied the Kate and William relationship to other things depicted in The Crown. William has other girlfriends before Kate, and there's a period where they break up and he dates other women. And I'm sure you remember, William was quite the heartthrob at this time.
Mm-hmm.
And he had sort of Diana's sort of shy little head duck thing, you know, that he would do from below his bangs. And like, he wasn't my type, but he was like undeniably just a very sort of charming looking guy. So he had no trouble finding the ladies and the ladies finding him. But many of the ladies who were of his own class or peerage or, you know, had titles and came from very moneyed families did not want the lifestyle that came with being chased by the paparazzi all the time and having to deal with, I mean, Kate was also stalked by the paparazzi quite a lot, but she was more willing to put up with it. For these other women who already have position, privilege, money, they can turn around and marry somebody else who's more like them, where they do not have to be hiding in the trunks of cars to get in and out of restaurants, taking the back alley, having to cancel plans all the time, you know, being surrounded by security at many intimate moments. Like, it sucks. It's like really draining. You asked me this the other day, would you trade the lifestyle you have right now, which is not necessarily glamorous, Joy, for being a royal? And I'm like, absolutely not. It sounds terrible. It sounds like being in prison, and just so stressful. Like, you can only do things wrong. And I've read the books and I have the manual, and I know that, you know, your press secretary is an incredibly important hire, and I still don't think I could do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so many, many other women kind of noped out of there. And I think he, in some ways, they could have made it about how the press pressure led us to having somebody like Kate who could endure the press,
yeah,
and was willing to.
That's fair. Yeah. Instead, it's a really uninteresting depiction of a love story. It's like, oh, these people are. And yes, the most interesting part is the mom engineering things, but like, that's about it. Everything else about it is like pretty standard.
Now, I will say that in, as Tina Brown recounts, they come to be known in the press over the years as the Duke and Duchess of Dull, because while she is very beautiful and they cut quite a striking figure, they just have this very domestic, homey, uninteresting life that's never fireworks. And that is, in some ways, you can imagine, again, that is incredibly appealing. I'm actually impressed that these two boys made it to adulthood in any functioning way whatsoever, given what they went through is so harrowing.
Yeah.
And I wish the show had also depicted a little bit more of how horrible it must have been.
Yeah.
But, you know, he has this very functional, well, okay, he did until a long time, for a long time, have what seemed like a flawlessly functioning home life.
Yeah.
Until very recently.
All right. The only other thing I want to say about these final episodes is I do think that the show ended really strong in terms of imagery. There's this very, yeah, very long shot of Queen Elizabeth walking into the light that goes on for like a full, I'm going to say 90 seconds or something.
Yeah, it's she
like
walks the length of this incredibly long chapel.
The whole length of this thing.
Yeah.
And I just thought that was like a very bold way to end the show, and appropriate. It's kind of beautiful. Beautiful way to end the show. It actually made me emotional to watch it. Because obviously the actual queen had passed by the point they were watching it. But it's also just like, hey, yes, the show has made up some horrifying shit about some of these people. And yes, it has basically used these real life people as though they're kind of cardboard cutouts on which the creators of the show want to project, you know, all this grand storytelling onto. But at the end of the day, you do get a sense of deep respect that people like Peter Morgan and other people behind the show have for what these people have gone through, I think. You know, despite all of the controversies around the show itself, I do think that there is this kind of, yeah, deep respect and desire to honor the sacrifices that these people have made for their country. And that comes through, and certainly with that final shot, it does as well. But did you want to transition into maybe talking about the show as a whole and what,
yeah,
you thought about that?
Yeah.
So Joy, what are your thoughts overall? You know, we've at this point watched all six seasons of the show. You've watched many seasons multiple times, if I recall correctly, right? Several seasons multiple times. So looking back on it, what are your thoughts?
Although I think at moments, it is honestly it is only an okay show. It has moments of incredible greatness and then moments that are meh. I think the moments that are great are worth it to watch the entirety of it. I do recommend the show to people. But what I find amazing is that despite all the liberties it takes and the possibly slightly exploitative nature of the exercise, I think the story is correct. You know, so as a former journalist, it has always bothered me. It's like, oh, you're really dramatizing moments that we don't know about. You're showing fights that happened behind closed doors. Like, how can you possibly take that much liberty? But based on having read Spare, I think thematically, yeah, it is all extremely correct. And so I just wonder who were the sources that fed to Peter Morgan, the show creator. I know other people have been observers of the palace, but, you know, because the palace has such a weird symbiotic relationship with the press that is partially antagonistic and partially like mutually infantilizing, it's hard to believe anything that you hear just from news reports. But from this memoir alone, the conflict between duty and family, the fishbowl feeling and the impossible balance between constant availability but also privacy that they have to balance, particularly as, you know, the show starts in season one. We see Elizabeth becoming queen, but also giving her wireless, her address to the Commonwealth via the wireless radio. So the wireless radio is like the new thing at the time she starts her reign, and she dies in the age of like Instagram. So she has to go through every single one of those communication channels and be theoretically, if not good at them, at least competent. And so how do you maintain your availability through all of that while still having some semblance of a personal self? So that struggle to be sort of seen while not really being heard. My God, this family loves hunting and the military so much. Like, that's all very accurate and clear. And then the really, really hard thing, which is that there's such a sense of hierarchy of needs within the family that is being managed and implemented by a professional staff. So Granny doesn't tell you, no, you can't have coffee with her. Someone calls and says, oh, she's unavailable. So there's like this middle layer of bureaucrats, like managing all your family relationships. And through it, your job is to remain stoic. All of that is the stuff that Harry incredibly struggles with. Like, therapy helps him to an extent. But I think, you know, I'm hopeful for him that maybe getting out of that environment, I don't think anyone can really thrive in that environment. I think it feels like Queen Elizabeth successfully endured it, but it was a great sacrifice and a great act of duty.
Yeah. I have brought this analogy up, I think, on our conversations of The Crown before, but Aaron Sorkin was talking about how he was, I think I'm remembering this correctly, where he was screening the movie Steve Jobs for one of the people in the movie that's like depicted in the film, a real life person that's depicted in the film, but like not an actor. And that person left the screening and said, none of that happened. All of it's true. That's kind of like, yeah. And you know, The Crown even does a little bit better than that. Some of that did happen, right? Some of the stuff that happened in The Crown did happen in real life, but like a lot of it is true. Like, it captures the essence of what these people actually went through. And
yes, I think it captures the essence accurately of some of their personalities.
Right. And so, yes, the Crown definitely fabricated a bunch of shit. Like, it made up a bunch of stuff and conversations that it couldn't have possibly known that happened or happened the way they did. Events that didn't happen, you know, like the Crown has definitely dabbled with that stuff. But at the end of the day, you know, you, Joy, as somebody who has spent many hours reading about the royals and studying them, your sort of assessment is that the show did an overall good job of depicting who these people are and what they went through, right?
And also the things that matter to them. The idea that Wallace Simpson and the abdication are so important and cast such a huge shadow over the entire structure of the family that they are, many of their choices are in reaction to that 30 years later, 50 years later, 70 years later. Like, that is, you know, there are ghosts that can haunt families, and that is one of them actively for them. This is actually true. Even again, like Harry brings it up in his own memoir. So he wonders, are we going to be outcast? Like
Wallace, right?
Well, Wallace was the interloper, but the king, I believe it was Edward, but his informal name was David. So that's the tricky thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's like, they're buried here outside this cottage that we refurbished. Am I even going to be allowed to be buried here? He is like revisiting after he has been effectively sort of exiled from the family. And it's poignant.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In terms of the show itself, I think I'm actually a little more positive on it than you are. I would describe the show overall, The Crown, as uneven. That there are some seasons that are really, really strong. I think season one is excellent, pretty much the whole way through.
Yeah.
And honestly, one of the reasons that makes season one excellent is that it's showing a person, like a normal person that you can relate to, thrust into an incredible, extraordinary situation, and you're watching how they deal with it. And honestly, that's why season four is also really strong, in my opinion, which is the first of the Diana seasons and shows Emma Corrin as Diana and struggling to survive in this family. And those, I think, were like the two of the best seasons of the show.
Yeah, I agree.
And, you know, in terms of like the different casts, like they've all been pretty good. I think that, you know, Claire Foy, very strong. Olivia Colman, obviously amazing. Imelda Staunton, not a bad actress, but like, I'm honestly shocked at how this show has handled the Queen in seasons five and six. I think they've done from a storytelling perspective, I think they've done such a disservice to this character that they built up over the course of the first four seasons. Like, Imelda Staunton was given almost nothing to do in the latter two seasons of the show until the very final few episodes.
I think that's because the showrunners were wimping out. I really do.
Right, right.
Take a position on somebody who never wants to be heard from. That's her whole job, is you don't know what she's thinking.
Yeah.
And they insert thoughts into her, I think, as she's nearing the end of her life. I think it would feel pretty sacrilegious.
I see. So they felt more okay with it showing what she might have thought 30 years ago or whatever.
I absolutely think it was a much more interesting depiction earlier in life, because you have the sort of benefit of hindsight.
Yeah.
And even the Queen apparently enjoyed watching the show. It's not every single royal is guaranteed or is confirmed to have watched every season of the show. But I think, you know, she did enjoy watching those early seasons.
Yeah. But overall, I thought it was a worthwhile experience to watch the show. Like you said, there are some incredible highs in the show and some really pretty cringy lows. But I'm grateful for the time I spent with it, and I feel like I've learned a lot about this family and the royals as an institution, and I do have some admiration for a lot of what they've been through. So I'm overall pretty positive on the show, despite all the highs and lows.
I think I actually am. I didn't disagree with anything you said, so maybe I'm just a little more positive.
You said it was okay. You said it was an okay show.
I was trying to find a way to average out the high highs and the occasional what is happening.
So I would give the show a BB minus, overall,
For every incredible Matt Smith, oh my God, Matt Smith as young Prince Philip is just seared in my head. How irascible and how much he's struggling with his role, and he's so charismatic, and you can see why she's so attracted to him, and yet at the same time you can see he's going to have to basically tame himself in order to fit into the structure. It's so memorable, so believable. And then when he becomes recast as Tobias Menzies, that was one of the most believable jumps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it was
totally.
So continuous. Totally. I totally bought it. Similarly, I really bought Margaret going from Vanessa Kirby to a much older actor, Helena Bonham Carter.
Mm-hmm.
And then Helena Bonham Carter to Leslie Manville. I was a little bit more of a strain for me, but overall, I thought that was a pretty good continuity.
I think the Vanessa Kirby plot of trying to marry Group Captain Townsend, that is one of the plots that sticks with me.
It's so
all
tragic.
all these promises of you'll get to marry him next year, or you'll get to marry him in these conditions, and then it just never happens. It's that's the one plot line that stays with me of this is what these people give up. And for what? For these kind of like archaic rules, right? That like in today's, certainly in today's day and age would not even, like if it happened 50 years later, it would be a completely different story, right?
Well, so, by the time she gets to her second love, right. You know, the one she does marry, it's the swinging 60s out there. Yeah. I don't know if you like catch that, but like, you know, all these huge amounts of social change are occurring.
Right.
And this family is just really trying to stay, keep on keeping on.
Yeah.
So anyway, I think there is like incredible casting at many times. And then every now and then we have Tony Blair in a bad wig.
Indeed.
And it just sort of yanks you out of all of that.
But anyway, at the end of the day, I enjoyed the show. And I've enjoyed our conversations about it. And we hope you have too, listening at Decoding TV. So those are our overall thoughts on The Crown Season 6 and on the show as a whole.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promote for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
All right. It's time to talk about what the hell is going on.
What the hell is going on? Okay, so
there's probably people listening just to get to this segment.
I'm sorry, yes.
So welcome.
This is not going to be the TikTok timeline of like, on this day she was seen with this dress, and on that day she went to...
Let's just briefly recap, right? Kate Middleton has not been seen at an official public appearance since December of this year. And there's
since then
there's been a sort of feeding frenzy on social media driven by a lot of people, including Stephen Colbert, kind of speculating what is going on with Kate Middleton. Is Kate Middleton okay? I don't think we're really going to get into the wild rumors that are out there. There's like so many wild rumors of like what is actually going on. But Joy, you kind of have a theory of what's...
No. Okay. I don't want to even say I do have a theory, but it's a sad theory and I don't really want to... we'll get there in a second. But what I want to say through my preparation for The Crown, being a mini royal stand-in expert, the one you could get, not the one you wanted, but the one you could mint, time you had. Can I fit all that on a card, do you think? Mm-hmm. The one that was available.
For the record, I think Joy has turned out to be way better than the person that I was trying to get.
Oh, that's so very kind. Yes. That's very kind. I learned a few things that I think are contextually really helpful for why is everybody going bananas now. So the first thing is that the press coverage of Meghan Markle was in fact incredibly vicious and awful. It was so unrelenting after a period of sort of fairy tale with the wedding. That was like the respite. There was planted stories that were planted being from palace aides of other camps, and things that, you know, are just the normal clickbait stuff, like maybe Meghan buys a dress one day and the headline will be, "You won't believe what Meghan bought on the high street." You know, like, so everything can be made to kind of feel like a quote-unquote story when it's just a small...
But it's safe to say the press really went after her in a vicious way. And if you want to get a sense of the specifics, you can actually watch the Netflix documentary about this, where Harry and Meghan speak in their own terms about, and it shows the press coverage, and it is extremely negative and unflattering, and would drive many people to a terrible state.
And one of the most famous side-by-sides is that Megan eats avocado toast, and it's like supposed environmentalist Megan caught eating avocados despite their, you know, whatever terrible carbon footprint. And then Kate Middleton is also shown eating avocado toast at a prior time, and it's like Kate loves avocados and what they do for the healthy glow of her skin.
Right. I don't think that's exactly quite it, but that's very close
to what
it is.
It's not verbatim, but imagine that kind of...
And there's many side-by-side... Like, if you Google, like, Kate versus Megan side-by-side, like, you'll see that Kate and Megan doing the same things, but being depicted in very different ways in the media.
Not to mention that some of the coverage, not a ton of it, but some of it was quite racist, like, overtly, horribly racist, and... It doesn't take a lot of that for you to feel like this whole country is like secretly, you know, just saying racial slurs about me behind my back. Okay, so the point I'm trying to make is that at the time that all of this is going down, and Meghan and Harry get into this in their documentary, it becomes clear to Harry that he does not have press people on his side.
Mm-hmm.
He does not have access to sue the press through the family law firm. He does not have access to his own communications people. He eventually gets them. But he really has decided from the time of his mother's passing onward that the press is the enemy. He starts to realize not everyone from within the palace thinks the press is the enemy. And by the time he is writing Spare, which was issued in the beginning of 2023, his message basically is, my family was in collusion with the press, and they chose the press over me and my wife.
Right. That somehow his family, including Prince William, benefited, and Charles, and Camilla, benefited from Harry and Meghan being depicted poorly, because it makes them look, because they can feed them stories. It's like, hey, don't write about this bad thing about William and Kate. Write about this bad thing about Harry and Meghan, and that'll
it's
make
a few
William,
things. Right. It's story trading, yes. Which you talked about, and actually you and I discussed this on a Patreon episode for your personal Patreon at patreon.com/Dave Chen.
Yes. Not necessarily common, but certainly a practice that journalists will, like, if a journalist has a story, they sometimes may choose to not write about that story if they are given a quote-unquote better story.
Right. So I said, as a previous American journalist, I said, that is rare, that is gross, please don't make us all sound that way. And since then, I have finished reading the Palace Papers, and Tina Brown basically says, Americans have very different standards for this. The British press, not so much. They are absolutely constantly playing the angles. They will literally make up shit they don't have. This is how we got into the incredibly famous, and I think this moment I'm going to talk about a little bit in some detail. There is a moment that Harry recounts, that Tina Brown recounts, that in which Rebecca Brooks, do you know who that is?
Yes.
The former editor
News of the World, right?
Of the News of the World, implicated in the phone hacking scandal, now the CEO of News Corp, I believe. Very, very senior in News Corp. A Rupert Murdoch hatchet woman. Claims that she has evidence that Harry did cocaine. Harry is like, that is impossible. That is not possible. But it leads to, because they go to the press office, Harry is young at the time, and they say, we have evidence that your son did cocaine. And so, which of course leads to Charles turning to Harry and saying, did you do cocaine? Were you photographed doing cocaine? Did that really happen? So all this internal strife and fighting over something that there's no evidence of, you know, I think maybe Harry actually did do cocaine at one point, but he was like, I knew that they could not have this.
Right.
It is recounted from his perspective, as well as Tina Brown's, that even though there's a bluff, she is then able to negotiate that into basically a pleading guilty on a lower charge, which is having done weed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, today, I think people would be like, okay, fine, who cares? You know, but at the time, it felt more upsetting. And everyone's got a different perspective on that. One is certainly like, how slimy to take your absolute, you know nothing, but you're able to parlay it into getting someone to admit something damaging on the record and just creating all this family strife for nothing. From Harry's telling, he was advised he needed to sit down and, you know, kind of admit to this and do all of these things. And he's like, I don't know why. Like, I don't see why I need to do this. Like, he's being thrown under the bus and he's basically still a kid. I think he was in his late teen years at this point. And he explicitly says he later finds out that what this does is that it is the idea of Camilla's press person to get Charles out of looking like the asshole who left Diana and left her abandoned. And then she ended up being, you know, killed because she didn't have her regular security around her.
Mm-hmm.
That's the narrative out there, is that Charles is negligent and terrible and a horrible human. And right. Pivot the story to Charles is a father, a single father who is struggling to cope with these children that are becoming out of control. And that is a narrative, according to Harry, that comes from Camilla's press person, and it helps Charles and therefore helps Camilla by getting them out of the Diana era and into a different era in which he has a different identity. And the idea that, I mean, Harry sounds incredibly bitter, which I would too if this was what I believed, which is that I was fed to the wolves over nothing to burnish your press reputation, and you traded me, basically, so that the story could come out with a certain slant. It just sounds like very unforgivable.
Sure, sure.
And Harry is not a big fan of Camilla. Mm. Let me say that.
So how is this connected to what's going on right now, in your opinion?
Thank you. I can go really down these rabbit holes. This family is so much more poisonously at each other's throats than we even get to see in The Crown.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, even than is depicted in Harry and Meghan or in the Oprah interview, they sort of talk about it
right.
obliquely.
Yeah.
You know, and in The Crown, to be fair, we do meet Camilla's press person. That is implied, again, just like Harry's drinking, is like, oh, this person's here. That's interesting. What's the point of that? You know, like, it feels like a giant Easter egg. So I believe that, given that it feels like this family will do anything to each other to deflect attention from themselves, what is most striking to people who followed Meghan Markle and saw how she got treated is the cacophonous silence from most of the British media over the last few months.
Mm-hmm. Right. Because Kate Middleton appeared in public in Christmas or December of 2023, and then went in for an abdominal operation.
A few weeks later, yeah. It's not like she's photographed going into the hospital.
Yeah.
She is basically described as, oh, it's an announcement. She had a planned procedure, and
right.
She'll be out for 10 to 14 days, and then she's going to need to recuperate until Easter. And they're basically saying, like, don't expect to see her.
Right.
Okay,
right.
Fine.
And one would expect that despite that, the press would still be going off and publishing a bunch of stories about Kate, like speculating what she has and, you know, trying to take pictures of her inside her house all the time, you know, like
yeah,
whatever.
There's so much truly made up shit that Harry like refutes. He'll just sort of throw into the book like, by the way, during this time, you know, this was said about me, this was said about me, this was said about me. And all of these things were untrue.
Right. So they could have easily just fabricated stuff, but they haven't, is the point that you're making, right?
I would at least at a minimum expect lifestyle stories that are like Kate Middleton turns to yogurt, you know,
yes.
According to a health specialist that you know Kate should right. be eating
we've been
yogurt.
Studying the Amazon packages arriving at Kate's house, and there's
we've
a lot
been
of
going through her
there's
trash.
A lot of yogurt receptacles in there, you know, like but there's none of that. So what is your theory as to why that's the case?
So the Iron Curtain that feels like it has descended around her actually feels quite ominous, and it is not a signal for people who watch this family of like, oh, it's business as usual. It actually, what's sad to me is back in January, she went in for the procedure. I was like, okay, great. And then I noticed, you know, there's not a lot of coverage of her. And people who are Meghan fans are lobbing bombs on the line. And they're like, oh, look who gets to have privacy, you know? Look who isn't in the press. Look who isn't being shredded for her absences. At the time, I thought, good for her. Finally, someone gets some privacy in this family.
Right.
Thank God. It finally worked.
Right. I remember this, yeah.
But as it goes on, it gets weirder and weirder. And as there is more demand from the public to just like show us a little something, it is met with such stony silence that I understand why people think it's nefarious. It's because it is in contrast to, one, the mean treatment of Meghan Markle, two, the fact that Kate has always been actually so good at this job. Like, she knows when she needs to be available. She can kind of read the tea leaves. She did not particularly want to, is my sense. Like, she has described it as a little bit scary, having to give birth and then appear in full makeup and heels very shortly thereafter, carrying, you know, showing the baby off outside the hospital. But the press demand was so high that it was impossible not to. So the idea that she wouldn't be able to prop herself up even on a pillow and look a little presentable to the world, it feels like it breaks character, what we know of her character. So that's the second thing.
Yep.
These are things that are suspicious.
Yes.
Right? The third thing is that god-awful Photoshop. She has had an interest in photography since college.
Right. But on Mother's Day, she published a photo on her Instagram account that's like, Happy Mother's Day. You know, UK has a different Mother's Day than the United States. And it was doctored. It had clearly been the result of photo editing. Multiple news organizations issued a kill notice on the photo, which is typically reserved for countries like North Korea. And Kensington Palace is no longer a trusted source. It's really starting to spiral because a lot of these news organizations need people to know that they are reliable. And so when a photo like this is issued that has such obvious inconsistencies, then the news orgs need to react and say, like, hey, like, we actually are trustworthy, therefore we're killing this photo. Anyway, it showed obvious signs of manipulation, and later Kate published a post saying, I too experiment with photo editing. That's theoretically supposed to explain what happened there.
I actually think that's a little bit believable because her mother's business, Party Pieces, she hired Kate because Kate was hanging around after school waiting for William to marry her, and Kate needed a job. And so Kate, like, would make photos and put them on the website. So I do think Kate knows her way around, like, a JPEG.
Yeah,
at least a little bit. Like, she would know the names of the file extensions.
Sure. She would probably be editing RAW then. But anyway, go ahead.
Okay. She just wasn't always to the manor born. You know, she didn't always have a fleet of servants to do her Photoshop bidding.
Right.
Finally, the fourth thing is they do have an active Instagram account. They're called the Waleses now. You know, William and Kate, the Prince and Princess of Wales. And I just cannot believe that they are unfamiliar with Instagram vernacular or ways that they could communicate much more directly rather than having to go through this very formal apparatus of the press office that then speaks to the printed press and the BBC, et cetera.
Well, I don't know that they're managing that Instagram. You know, there's someone on staff that's like doing the posting probably, right? So,
Yes, and I think they know what Instagram is, you know? Just like the Queen had to learn what the wireless was, I think they're well into the age of Instagram.
You're asking, like, why hasn't Kate done an Instagram live, or why hasn't Kate posted an Instagram story that like would resolve, like, literally there would still be doubters out there, but it would certainly do a lot to quell the questions. Right?
So when you pair kind of like, my gosh, what a breaking character from like how they manage the press, how she typically just shows up and keeps her, you know, zips her lip and she puts on a good smile and, you know, looks nice and, you know, does all the things to be presentable. On the one hand, and then this giant meta narrative, which is like, wow, this job is incredibly crushing, you know, which is what we've seen 6 seasons of The Crown be about. This job is so crushing, and people in it don't always behave well. So we've lost Prince Andrew, we've lost Prince Harry, we've lost Meghan. Like, there's not even very many royals left. You would think you would desperately need to protect the 4 principals, Charles, Camilla, William, and Kate, and keep them just ultra bulletproof, Teflon, you know, like, reputationally.
Maintain their images in the public.
Right, because this family has nothing but their image.
Right.
So I now think, as the days go by, a couple things. I think it's probably sad. I think the story underneath it is probably not a fun one. And I'm feeling worse and worse about
There's probably some underlying health issue going on that has resulted in this behavior that you have described.
Or this woman who may or may not have changed her college at the last minute from something that looked like Harvard to something that looked like Amherst.
Who are you talking about? Kate?
Yeah.
Okay. Kate Middleton. Yes.
Yes. Kate Middleton transferred colleges after hearing that he was transferring going to, who has just played such an incredibly long and patient game, has snapped. Like, what would it take for that to happen? Like, that is an awful lot to imagine, you know? So it's health, whether it's marriage, whether it's the role has gotten to her.
Physical health, mental health, you know,
Or the role has become untenable for her.
Yeah.
Who is just, she just seems the closest to the queen in terms of her just dogged determination to show up every day and not make it about her and be the right amount of seen. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, yes.
I just feel like it's not great.
Yeah. Now, certainly, as we're recording this on March 21st, 2024...
Certainly, everything could change.
We are in the middle of the story. We're in the middle of the story. And so, by the time you're hearing this, maybe something will have broken, and you'll know more about the story. But as we're recording this right now, it does seem like there is a lot of unknowns still. There are a lot of unknowns still out there about how this is going to play out.
I would say probably, based on what I've read, that there will be infighting within the different palaces about how to handle it. Charles, apparently, according to Tina Brown, but especially according to Harry, his reaction to every single piece of bad press is just don't read it. Just don't read it. Just ignore it. And I think it is shocking to imagine, again, that a family that needs the press and press complicity, press adoration in order to exist could say our way to cope with all the bad press is simply not to acknowledge that it exists. But there is such a profound sense from the top, now that Charles is at the top of the pyramid, that you do not dignify any of this because you just make it worse down the road.
Never complain, never explain? Is that what it is? Yeah.
Did that work in the wireless era? Maybe. Did it work in the TV era? Eh. You remember there's like sort of like a poorly received documentary about the royal family that they decide to open up Buckingham Palace and people are like, wow, these people really live unrelatable lives, was the takeaway. But at the velocity that things move today, I can understand they don't want to give into the wild theories and the wild speculation, but they also are really playing ball the least at the time
that they need
when
to the
people
most.
Would have the most demand for it. I don't know if they need to, but do you understand?
I do understand. And in a way, that is what the show, The Crown, has been about. It has been about the collision of this extremely old institution with modernity, with the communication demands of the modern era. And we are basically living in season 7 right now. It's
absolutely,
it's remarkable.
Yes.
It's remarkable. It's just... Yeah, it's astonishing that we are witnessing this kind of conflict between like their old school ways of doing things and just post some Instagram stories, man. That's all we're asking for. No, I'm not asking for anything, but I'm just saying, like, you know, they clearly are still trying to do things in the old way or in an old school way, and it is not serving them well.
Well, it's all they have. They have a very limited toolkit to preserve their dignity and sanity.
Yeah,
and this is kind of all that's left to them. So anyway, I hope she's fine. My best guess is there's a sad reason we may not hear it for a long time.
Yeah.
She will soft launch, reemerge at
Easter, which is the current announced date.
Yeah, but she doesn't have, they said after Easter, you know, so she doesn't have anything publicly on the calendar. It'll really, really suck for her as she kind of reemerges because she will once more get stalked, not as if she's an uninteresting mom of three, but as if she's a figure of
international,
like, where in the world is Carmen Sandiego? And, you know, hopefully it will equilibrium. I mean, I don't even know what I hope for this family, because the show does not have a clear ending except for this narrative insert, right, of her thinking back on the time that she's been queen. Because this story does not have an ending. It is just the same, in reality, it is the same forces that continue to torment generation after generation. And so I really don't know. There can be a next chapter. I just don't know how it can end, quote unquote.
Right. Like, what is the universe? If the monarchy were to come to an end, how would that even happen? Mechanically, how would that even happen? Right.
I'm haunted by this tweet that I told you about, mm-hmm. which is like, what if the way the monarchy ends is like Charles is off getting homeopathic treatment in a garden, Camilla flies off on vacation, Kate just disappears. They literally all just kind of wander away and then it's over.
Yeah. I don't think it's going to play out quite like that.
Probably not.
You know, who knows?
Probably not.
Joy, is there anything else you wish to discuss?
No, I will say, as a book review, I think Spare is worth your time. It is an easy read. It is pretty, it's obviously one person's recollection.
As told through a ghostwriter, yeah.
A really good ghostwriter.
Yeah. The ghostwriter wrote a piece. I read that piece and it was really interesting to hear about that process.
So. I think as a book, it mostly is really clear and really strong. And then it has some very interesting, strange anecdotes, which I know people have seen in the press. But it is very odd to think about Kate Middleton and Will's wedding day. You think Harry's going to have a lot to say about this momentous occasion. He has some things to say. He is very preoccupied that day with whether he has frostbite on his penis from a very recent trip to the North Pole, which everyone told him, don't take. It's too close to the wedding. What if you get stuck up there? And he doesn't quite make it, so he has to be helicoptered the final bit. He's so unprepared for this trek to the North Pole, clearly. Who makes a last minute trek to the North Pole, squeezing that right in before your brother's wedding?
Someone who wants to live.
Yeah, I do think he wants to live. And he really feels the effects.
All right. Well, I know this conversation about The Crown has come quite a bit later than we said it would, but we hope you've enjoyed this and that it's given you some.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Stuff to think about. I want to say a big thank you to all of the paid subscribers at DecodingTV.com who keep this podcast going. We really appreciate it. And if you have any thoughts on this episode, if you want us to discuss that new Prince Andrew Netflix movie, shoot us an email at DecodingTV@gmail.com. Of course, I also want to thank Joy, who spent many hours preparing for these conversations we've had about The Crown. I hope you have benefited from her expertise. And Joy, thank you so much for all the work you've done.
It's been a pleasure.